All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, we always like to bring you the most fascinating, most pivotal cases. And today, well, today we're going to be going deep on a Massachusetts decision. This one's from 2015, Commonwealth versus Gomes. And it really gets to the heart of, you know, how courts are trying to keep up with science, especially when it comes to how reliable are eyewitnesses, you know, memory, all that.
Absolutely. Gomes is like a perfect example of how tricky things can get in law, when what we know about how our minds work keeps changing, you know, and how that impacts how we look at evidence. Huge implications for the courtroom.
Right. Yeah. So let's break it down. Let's get into, you know, the facts of the case. What exactly was going on in Commonwealth versus Gomes? Set the scene for us.
OK, so it all starts back in 2011 with this this incident. Jeremy Gomes, he's the defendant, right? He allegedly attacks this guy, Zachary Savini, slashes his face with a box cutter.
Oof, that's brutal.
Yeah, it was nasty. And it wasn't like totally random. They had some kind of beef before, like a run-in at a convenience store or something. But this attack, this happens in a parking lot, well-lit, lots of people around.
Okay, so witnesses, right? That's where this eyewitness stuff comes in.
Exactly. So after the attack, you have the victim, Savini, and then other folks who were there. They all point to Gomes, say he's the one who did it. And they do this through, you know, the usual procedures, photo arrays, you know, lineup of pictures, and also a show up where they bring Gomes in, like, alone for a witness to see.
Okay, so it seems pretty open and shut, right? Multiple IDs, well-lit scene. What's the problem?
Well, that's where things get interesting, right? See, at the trial, Gomes's lawyers, they make this argument about how the jury should be told to think about eyewitness testimony. They wanted the judge to give instructions, like specific guidance that reflects, you know, the latest science on memory on what makes eyewitness accounts reliable or not.
Like, instead of just, did they see him?
Yeah, like more nuanced stuff. They even pointed to like other states, like New Jersey, that were already using these more modern instructions. Like, hey, look, this is how we should be doing it.
And what were they doing in Massachusetts at the time? Like, what was the standard way of handling this?
Back then, it was all based on this older case from 1979, Commonwealth versus Rodriguez. And those instructions, they were like way more general, you know, like, was the lighting good? How far away was the witness? Did they have enough time to see what happened?
So like common sense stuff.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. It relied more on like what jurors might naturally think about, you know, instead of like all this research from cognitive science that had come out since, you know, the 79 case. But Gomes's defense, they wanted the jury to get this like deeper understanding of how memory actually works.
Makes sense. So what did the judge do? Did they go with the newer instructions?
Nope. The judge stuck with the old Rodriguez instructions. Their reasoning was basically that this new science the defense was talking about, it wasn't like officially recognized in Massachusetts law yet, you know, not generally accepted, like the legal term is. Plus, Gomes's lawyers, they didn't bring in an expert witness at the trial to like really explain all the science to the court and the jury. So that was a missed opportunity.
Okay, missed opportunity. Got it. So Gomes is convicted. What happens next? Does he appeal?
Oh, he absolutely appeals. And one of his big arguments is like, hey, the judge messed up by not using these updated instructions on eyewitnesses. And he also claims his trial lawyer basically screwed up by not bringing in that expert, you know, to back up their argument for the new instructions.
The old ineffective assistance of counsel. Tough one to prove, though, right?
It is. It is. But, you know, they had to try. So the case goes up to the Supreme Judicial Court, the SJC, Massachusetts' highest court, and they take a look at it.
And what did the SJC say? Did they agree with Gomes?
Initially, no. They upheld the trial judge's decision about the jury instructions. They said, basically, look, back in 2012 when this trial happened, this science wasn't settled law in Massachusetts. So the judge was fine to stick with the Rodriguez instructions. No problem there.
Okay, so the timing matters here. What about the lawyer? Did they think he should have called an expert?
Well, they had to apply this like super strict standard. You know, it comes from a Supreme Court case, Strickland versus Washington. And basically, to prove your lawyer was so bad it messed up your whole trial, you got to show two things. One, that the lawyer was actually incompetent, like did things no reasonable lawyer would do. And two, that this incompetence, it actually harmed your case. You know, change the outcome.
High bar for sure.
Yeah. And the SJC, they said, well, maybe not calling an expert, it could have been a strategy, you know? Maybe the lawyer was worried the expert would bomb on the stand or that the jury wouldn't like them. So they didn't see it as like a clear-cut case of incompetence.
Okay, so the SJC is saying basically, based on the law at the time, the trial was fair.
Yeah, that's the gist. But, and this is important, even though they upheld the conviction, the SJC did something really interesting. They acknowledged that the science on eyewitness identification, it was changing, and they needed to pay attention to that.
So that's where this case gets really interesting.
Right. See, in their 2015 decision, they specifically mentioned this report, a big one, from 2013. It's called the Supreme Judicial Court Study Group on Eyewitness Evidence Report. And this report, it kind of changed the game.
Okay. And this report, it laid out some, like, key findings, right? New scientific stuff that everyone was starting to agree on.
Exactly. The SJC, they pulled out five main principles from this report that they said, okay, these are now generally accepted, and we need to use these to guide how we tell juries to think about eyewitnesses from now on. And these principles, they're, like, much more specific, much more in line with what we know about memory now.
Okay, so let's dive into those, because I think this is where things get really useful for, you know, law students listening. Principle number one, what is it?
Okay, so first off, memory, it's not like a video recording, right? It's not just playing back what happened perfectly. It's a three-stage process. You have acquisition, that's when you first see the event. Then retention, how that memory gets stored in your brain over time. And then retrieval, when you try to remember it later. And each of these steps, they can be messed with, you know? Things can go wrong.
So it's not just about forgetting, it's about how the memory itself can change.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And that leads to the second principle, which is, like, even if a witness seems super sure about their ID, it doesn't mean they're right, especially if they weren't that sure right at the beginning.
So confidence can be misleading.
Totally. We tend to think, oh, they're so certain, must be accurate, but that's not always how it works. Principle number three gets into stress. Like, if a witness was super stressed during the crime, that can actually hurt their memory.
Really? So, like, the adrenaline rush, all that, messes with your ability to remember.
Exactly. Like, you'd think you'd be hyper aware, but it can actually work the opposite way. Then you have principle number four, post-event information. Basically, anything a witness hears or sees after the crime, even if it's accidental, it can change their memory.
So, like, talking to other witnesses, seeing news reports, even the way the police ask questions.
All of that. It can, like, warp the original memory without the person even realizing it. And finally, principle number five, that's about prior viewings. Like, if a witness has seen the suspect before, like in a photo array, it can mess up later IDs.
Right. So if they see the same face again, they might get confused about where they saw it.
Yeah. It's like their memory is getting contaminated. They might pick the person because they're familiar, not because they actually remember them from the crime.
Okay. So these five principles, they really paint a much more complex picture of eyewitness testimony than just, like, was it dark or how far away were they? So why did the SJC go to all this trouble to outline them?
Well, they wanted to make sure that juries, you know, the people who ultimately decide what's true in a case, they wanted them to have the best, most accurate information about how eyewitnesses work based on the science. And they were walking a fine line here, you know. They wanted to be up to date with the science, but also not jump the gun if things were still, like, being debated.
So kind of like a balance between being current and being cautious.
Yeah, exactly. And they specifically said, look, from now on, we want judges to use these principles in their instructions to the jury. And they had good reasons for that. They said instructions are, like, more direct, more authoritative. It's the judge talking, right? And it's free. You don't need to hire some fancy expert.
Plus, you avoid that whole battle of the experts thing.
Right, where you have one expert saying one thing, another saying the opposite, and the jury is just left confused. Instructions cut through all that noise.
Okay, so the SJC lays down these principles. They say use them in future cases. But what about Gomes? Did his conviction get overturned?
This is the tricky part, right? Even though they said these principles are important, they still upheld most of Gomes' convictions.
Wait, what? So they recognized the science but didn't apply it to him?
Well, it comes back to timing. They said, look, back when Gomes was tried in 2012, these principles weren't settled law yet. So it wouldn't be fair to overturn his conviction based on something the courts hadn't fully embraced yet.
Okay, so kind of like, yeah, we messed up, but we didn't know it at the time.
Sort of, yeah. It was more like, this is how we're doing things going forward, but we can't go back and change every old case. They did, however, vacate one of his convictions.
Yes, the outline mentioned that. Which one was it and why?
Yeah, the one for assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. They tossed that one out. But it wasn't because of the eyewitness stuff. It was this legal thing called the merger doctrine.
Merger doctrine, huh? Sounds complicated.
It's not that bad. Basically, they said that assault charge, it was kind of swallowed up by the mayhem charge, you know, the one about permanently disfiguring the victim's face. It would be like punishing him twice for the same act.
So they just got rid of the redundant charge.
Exactly. So, Gomes, it's this weird case where the guy mostly loses, but the case itself ends up being super important for everyone else going forward.
Right, because it forces the Massachusetts courts to get up to speed with the science on eyewitnesses.
Exactly. It's a prime example of how the law is constantly evolving, trying to incorporate new scientific knowledge to make trials more fair, more accurate. And this isn't just a Massachusetts thing, you know, this is happening all over as we learn more about how our minds work.
And Gomes, it wasn't just a one-off, right? The outline mentions some later cases that built on this.
Oh, yeah. There have been a bunch. Like Commonwealth versus Creighton, that one really dug into the whole idea of in-court identifications. Like, if a witness hasn't ID'd the defendant before, is it even fair to let them do it in court for the first time?
Sounds like a recipe for, like, suggestive stuff, right?
Yeah.
The witness sees the defendant sitting there with the lawyer, the whole courtroom atmosphere.
Exactly. And Creighton, it basically said, look, you got to have a good reason to let that happen. It can't just be, like, a random in-court pointing. And that's directly related to the concerns the SJC raised in Gomes about memory being unreliable, procedures being suggestive, all that.
So even though Gomes himself didn't get much relief, his case really changed the landscape for eyewitness identification in Massachusetts.
Absolutely. It's a reminder that sometimes, you know, the law takes a while to catch up to the science, but it does get there eventually. And for all you future lawyers out there, that's a key takeaway. You got to be aware of both the law and the science and how they're constantly pushing and pulling on each other.
Well said. So to sum up for our listeners, Commonwealth versus Gomes, it's not just about the specifics of that case. It's about how the courts are wrestling with this really complex issue of memory and how we use it in trials.
And it highlights how important it is to keep up with the latest scientific research, because that's what's driving changes in the law, in how we think about evidence, how we conduct trials.
And that's a wrap for our deep dive on Commonwealth versus Gomes. A fascinating look at a pivotal case, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And it leaves us with a lot to think about, you know? Like, what happens as we keep learning more about our minds, about bias, about all the ways memory can be tricky? How will that shape the law in the future?
A question for all our listeners to ponder. Until next time, keep diving deep, folks.
Keep learning.